Moving on to leukemia. Leukemia is a malignant disease with unregulated proliferation of one particular cell type, and there is significant accumulation of blast cells in the marrow. You can have either chronic or acute types of leukemia. In chronic, the onset tends to be a little bit slower and it's usually less aggressive. The cells involved are generally more mature cells, whereas in acute, the onset is very rapid, the disease is very aggressive, and the cells involved are generally very poorly differentiated, and there's a significant amount of blasts present.
This is the one we always hear about, like in the news.
Right. Yes. It's the acute that you always hear about in the news. There's four basic types: CML, AML, CLL, and ALL. So chronic myelogenous leukemia, CML, and acute myelogenous leukemia, AML. They both have the M in it, so they are myeloid precursor cells. That is the origination of that type of leukemia. CLL, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and ALL, acute lymphocytic leukemia, are of lymphoid precursor origin. ALL is the one that you think of with children, and the others tend to happen in adults. So AML is the acute that happens in adults, typically. It can happen different than that, but as a general rule, ALL happens in children. So all kids is how you can remember that. We have actually a graphic on the handout or the study guide that summarizes acute versus chronic leukemias and where those cells are coming from, the onset, and the type of presentation that you're seeing in terms of splenomegaly, lymphadenopathy, thrombocytopenia, and anemia, etc. I'm not going to go through that entire chart here because I think it's easier to look at. Would you agree, Rich?
Yeah, definitely easier to look at.
Okay, so the chart will summarize mostly, you know, all of those types in one thing. We can talk a little specifically about acute leukemias here. So those symptoms that are presented with are coming from basically bone marrow failure and tissue infiltration of malignant cells. So you can end up with leukostasis and B symptoms, of course, pancytopenia, requiring transfusions frequently. The thing about acute leukemia is that actually transfusions often don't work for a very long time. So you might expect typically a patient who receives a unit of packed red blood cells, you would expect that to last for roughly 4 weeks. And in an acute leukemic situation, you're not going to see 4 weeks out of that generally, because they just don't work that well. The bone marrow is in such failure and there's so much accumulation of blast cells that there's no space for any healthy cells to be present. In lab work, you'll see an elevated white blood cell count. It can be normal to low, but typically you'll see it high. You'll obviously see a very significant amount of blast cells in the peripheral blood. The blast cells in the peripheral blood are a guideline, but the actual amount will be shown in a bone marrow biopsy. It's generally higher than what is shown in the peripheral blood. You will see some anemia, thrombocytopenia, neutropenia, of course. So diagnosis, of course, is based off of bone marrow biopsy, and you will see greater than 20% blast cells in that bone marrow. AML shows typically hour rods, which is these like elongated little rods that show up in the cytoplasm. ALL does not have any hour rods present, and there's a picture of that if you need to see that on the handout. Treatment for acute leukemias, both for ALL and AML, typically it's either a combination of chemo and radiation or stem cell transplant, depending on the individual case. Stem cell transplant can be either autologous or allogenic or even syngenic, taken from stem cells from the blood, bone marrow, or umbilical cords. You want to talk a little bit more, Rach, about stem cell transplants?
Yeah, so stem cell transplants, like we said, there's several types. The autologous stem cell transplant or allogenic stem cell transplants. In Canada, they can only be done on patients who are under the age of 65. Patients first have to receive chemotherapy to reduce the number of circulating cancer cells. People end up in a sort of... make them extremely immune compromised before we do this. You have to be very well isolated.
It kind of gives you like an idea if the cancer is even going to be responsive to the chemo, right? So we chemo first.
Yeah, chemo first for sure. And then stem cells are harvested from the patient via bone marrow or peripheral blood. And then the patient undergoes high-dose chemo to cause significant cell death to the bone marrow. And then the patient receives new transplanted stem cells because it won't work if they've still got their bone marrow is full of cancer cells still. We have to get rid of them first before we can put in
We kill everything.
Potentially healthy cells.
Yeah. Okay. So that's the – it's a very summarized gist of what a stem cell transplant is. So let's move on and talk a little bit about the chronic leukemia. So first, CML. Again, a clonal stem cell malignancy, as all of these are, and greater than 95% of them have the Philadelphia chromosome. So that's what you need to remember about CML, is they have the Philadelphia chromosome. And that comes along with translocation 922. And you treat this with Gleevec or imatinib is the standard of care. It used to be a very deadly illness, and it's now become more of a chronic disease because of this treatment. They actually have a normal life expectancy. CLL, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, is a myeloproliferative disorder. Again, a clonal stem cell malignancy, as all of these are. Sometimes you'll see this classified as a leukemia, and sometimes you'll see it classified as a lymphoma. It just kind of depends on the source that you're looking at. The diagnosis is made via flow cytometry, the specific CLL phenotype, or through bone marrow biopsy showing CLL present and its cytogenetics. And in the staging, they use something called the RAI system, R-A-I. They do not use the TNM staging system. We do have a chart on the study guide that reviews this. The RAI stages go 0, 1, 2, 3, and 4. I don't think you have to know this in great detail, but it does assess the patient's risk category, specific cytogenetics of the disease, and where it is all present, whether it's just in the lymphocytes, whether the spleen is affected as well as the lymph nodes, etc. And treatment for this is chemotherapy based. There's different combinations and treatment regimens that are available depending on the individual case.
Now we're going to move on and talk about multiple myeloma. So multiple myeloma is the second most common hematologic malignancy. It's more prominent in men than in women, and the Canadian five-year relative survival rate is 43%, according to the Canadian Cancer Society. The peak age is 65 to 70 years old. This is something you get later in life, typically. It's a malignancy of plasma cells. Abnormal plasma cells accumulate in the bone marrow and produce paraproteins and abnormal immunoglobulins. Precancerous condition is called monoclonal gammopathy of unknown significance, or MGUS. And this is often just followed and to make sure it doesn't turn into multiple myeloma.
Right.
Smoldering myeloma is an indolent form of multiple myeloma that has no symptoms. And this, again, will often turn into multiple myeloma. The development of MMM sort of follows a progression. You get MGUS or
MGUS. MGUS, right, yeah.
And then a smoldering diagnosis, and then that develops into multiple myeloma.
That people present with bone pain, recurrent infections, weight loss, fatigue. They can have fractures, blood clots, even have neurologic symptoms, and that's basically secondary to hypercalcemia. Neuropathy also can happen. And of course, these are clinical features of multiple myeloma, not of smoldering myeloma or MGUS, as those present asymptomatically. On the labs, you'll find the classic thing that you need to remember is lytic bone lesions, because you'll see those on just a plain old x-ray. You'll see these circular lytic lesions. Their CBC will show some anemia, leukopenia, thrombocytopenia. They may present with renal failure. Again, this is related to hypercalcemia. They'll show then an increased creatinine, obviously, and uric acid. They can have proteinuria as well as CAS present, and an elevated beta 2 microglobulin. That's not a test that I think we do very frequently, and it's a bit outdated, but it is, they do have elevated levels of that as well. In terms of diagnosis, the key things to order, serum protein electrophoresis and a light chain electrophoresis, those would essentially show an elevated M protein. Bence-Jones proteins will be in the urine, and you might see IgA and IgG as the most common types of plasma proteins that are abnormal. The serum protein electrophoresis, that is ultimately the diagnosis here, measures immunoglobulin levels. And as I mentioned, the elevated M protein is the one that's usually found in multiple myeloma. So you're going to see normal levels of normal immunoglobulins, and then you'll see these abnormal immunoglobulin levels show up as well. You have to make sure that you also get the light chain electrophoresis, because if you think of the shape of an immunoglobulin, you have the heavy chains and the light chains, and you can have multiple myeloma that's only present on the light chain. So you want to make sure that you are assessing both of those. There, we have a chart on the study guide that outlines the official diagnosis of between MGUS, smoldering myeloma, and multiple myeloma. Essentially, these are just different levels of monoclonal proteins being present, as well as plasma cells presence and end organ disease. I think the really key thing to remember here is that multiple myeloma is the only one that shows end organ disease. And in order to have the diagnosis of multiple myeloma, you need to have some kind of evidence of that, either that be lytic bone lesions, hypercalcemia, renal failure, anemia, etc. You need to have some evidence of that. Whereas smoldering myeloma and MGUS, you're not going to have any symptoms or really evidence shown in your lab values. The mainstay of treatment here for MGUS and smoldering myeloma, Rachel, you already said, is just observation for those people. Make sure it doesn't turn into multiple myeloma. And then once it does, you use chemo. Some that you might have heard, bortezomib, also known as Velcade, lenalidomide, also known as Revlimid. You want to make sure you give these people bisphosphonates as well, IV bisphosphonates. And then, of course, there's stem cell transplant as an option.
And that wraps up our lectures on lymphoma and leukemia. So we're going to go back to our case.
In our case, the 68-year-old male who was presenting with bony pain in his left hip and femur, which was new. He was having some neuropathic symptoms, some neuropathy in his tingling in his hands and feet, which is also new and seemed to be worsening. And he's otherwise a pretty healthy person. And his lab values showed a low hemoglobin of 100. His white count was 2.5, and his platelets were low at 100 as well, even though his iron and B12 studies were normal. So the iron and B12 didn't explain the low hemoglobin. His creatinine was elevated at 180, eGFR 45. Electrolytes, the calcium was 3.8. Normal value is between 2.0 and 2.6. So this is an elevated calcium level. The remaining electrolytes were at normal limits, and his urinalysis showed proteinuria and CAS, but no nitrates or nitrites, glucose, or blood. And his initial x-rays of the left hip and femur showed multiple scattered lytic bone lesions. So,
it's multiple myeloma.
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear that we are dealing with multiple myeloma here, but we do have to officially diagnose this. And so even though we're seeing lytic bone lesions on the x-ray, and he's certainly presenting with these symptoms, what are we going to actually order to diagnose this?
So we need a serum plasma electrophoresis, serum light chain electrophoresis,
right?
24-hour urine collection, and with the Bence-Jones protein, the beta-2 microglobulin if we can.
Right. Yeah, sure. We can add the beta-2 microglobulin for sure. And then, of course, we're going to end up needing a bone marrow biopsy as well.
And what does his bone marrow biopsy show?
It showed monoclonal stem cell disease with 13% plasma cells. Above 10 ends up putting us in the category of multiple myeloma when you combine it with the elevated calcium and the anemia and the lytic lesions. So this patient is having evidence of has a high level of plasma proteins in the bone marrow, and he has end organ disease affecting his kidneys, his bones, and his peripheral blood. Okay, so we can treat him with chemo. I mean, he's obviously going to go on see an oncologist for that. But let's talk about a couple things of why is this MGUS and not smoldering myeloma? Let's just review.
That would be because he has end organ involvement. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the big difference between MGUS and smoldering myeloma, right?
Yeah, that's the big deal that we want to remember.
Why is his calcium elevated?
It's secondary to the bone lesions, to the lytic lesions. So basically, the myeloma starts eating away at the bones, and it leaches the calcium from the bones out into the peripheral blood, so thus raising the calcium levels. And then, obviously, that's going to lead to the poor kidney function. The kidneys can't handle high calcium, and it can also lead to mental status changes, etc. So we do want to make sure we treat that. Standard treatment for that is going to be IV fluids and IV bisphosphonates.
Okay. And what type of chemo do we typically use for these patients?
So there's many options, but standard, you know, first line is going to be something like bortezomib or lenalidomide. And you don't have to really remember that. I don't think that's going to be on the exam. They're names that you should just kind of recognize as related to multiple myeloma.
So how does this patient do after we treat him?
Initially, he does really well and responds to the chemo just fine. However, now, it's a few years later, he's 72. He's on lenalidomide, also known as Revlimid, and he presents to the emergency room with
epistaxis or nosebleed.
And it's uncontrollable. He's unable to stop the bleeding. We pack his nose. We try to get the bleeding under control. You talk to him. He says he feels fatigued, but otherwise he's feeling pretty well. But we got to figure out why this is happening, right?
Yep. So he's got a history of multiple myeloma, and now he's coming in with nosebleeds and fatigue. So we're going to do an exam. He hasn't had an obvious injury to his face or nose. No obvious abnormalities inside, nothing visible inside the nares. There's no huge tumor or anything. His vitals were okay. His blood pressure is a bit low, 112, 176. Temperature is 38, so that's really quite high. Heart rate of 88 and rest rate of 18. And the remainder of the exam was within normal limits. So now we have a gentleman with a nosebleed on chemotherapy, temperature of 38. So now we got to
get some labs, right?
Better get a workup. This isn't a normal nosebleed. So we order some labs. We're going to order a CBC. And it comes back with white count of 0, ANC of 0, and a hemoglobin of 74 and platelets of 15.
Okay, so we definitely know that's all wrong, yeah. All that.
Yeah, very, very, very wrong, but not typical for multiple myeloma, so now we're in a bit of a quandary.
Yeah, so is it possible that the chemo is doing this to this patient? Like,
yeah, it's possible. I mean, he's been on it for, he was 65 when he got diagnosed.
Yeah, he's been on it for a number of years. It's been working well, so it would be unusual that just out of the blue for it to do that, right?
Yeah, but we're going to treat this as a febrile neutropenia from an eMERGE perspective, but we also have to figure out what's going on, why his blood work suddenly looks really bizarre.
So actually, while we are working on the febrile neutropenia, you know, getting – so we're going to start him on some IV antibiotics and, you know, get him admitted and – get him on some Tylenol.
Yep, and we're going to transfuse him, probably give him platelets. Well, no, his platelets are 15, so we probably wouldn't transfuse platelets yet, but we'd have to keep a close eye on them.
Unless we can't stop the bleeding, right? Yeah. Like, because of the bleeding. So I guess you could go either way on that. But then the pathologist actually happens to call and says he's concerned about these labs.
Yep. He thinks that the patient has a new acute leukemia, which seems really odd because he already has
a diagnosis of a cancer.
Of a bone marrow related cancer. So a second bone marrow related cancer would be unusual.
At this point, I suppose we better call the oncologist.
Yeah. At this point, you would definitely call the patient's oncologist. Presumably, if they had multiple myeloma for 7 years, they're under the care of oncology. If you can't get this patient's oncologist, you'll call the oncologist on call and get some guidance.
We tell the oncologist, okay, we're treating as febrile neutropenia. We're getting blood cultures times 2. We're getting urine culture, chest x-ray. We're starting IV antibiotics, and we're transfusing blood products. And then that, you know, do we think that this is another issue? Do we need a bone marrow biopsy? And actually, the oncologist says, let's stabilize the patient first and then reassess once he's stable with a bone marrow biopsy at that point, right?
Hold his chemo drugs and hopefully it'll bounce back if it's related to the Revlimid or the chemo.
The patient stabilizes, we treat the febrile neutropenia, and he undergoes another bone marrow biopsy, and it shows a plasma cell count of 3% and a blast count of 28% with our rods. So what is the likely diagnosis at this point?
So now he has acute myelogenous leukemia.
Yeah. So the plasma cell count of 3%, this is actually really good in terms of a multiple myeloma perspective because, yes. I mean, it was actually much higher before. But what was it before? 13%. So it's actually down to 3%. Multiple myeloma is doing really well. And a blast count of 28%, it's not good. Remember, anything above 20% is leukemia. And the hour rods are very typical of AML. So unusual case, but he has both multiple myeloma and acute myelogenous leukemia. Moving forward for this patient, what would we be doing and helping him with? How would we treat it?
I think would likely in this case probably just be supportive care through blood transfusion, platelet transfusion, antibiotics, antivirals, antifungals. Multiple myeloma and AML, his prognosis is probably not good. So,
right, depending and at on the age of 72, family, right,
it would be focusing on quality of life.
Right, I think you're right. AML is super aggressive, doesn't respond very well to chemo, and he's not going to qualify for bone marrow transplants. So, nope.
And he may not want one either.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So. They're very difficult to undergo. So that'll conclude our very lengthy case for our blood cancer section. And join us on the next lecture.